Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Madison, I apologize. I actually forgot to tell, well, I didn't tell you because I only had 30 seconds. If you could go back to the gospel reading, and we're just kind of, we're going to go through that almost, not quite line by line, but section by section, because this is one of those unique passages where there's a lot there. There's a lot to understand, and there's a lot that is misunderstood, if that makes sense. So it's worth just kind of going through that. Like back when I was more, or in a different Christian denomination, this is basically expository preaching, and they would say this is the only way to do it. Turns out it can be really useful. Don't tell the seminary I said that. Before this moment, though, it's important to note two things. Jesus had, at some point beforehand, sent his disciples out, and in doing so, he gave them power to heal, power over like, demonic forces and stuff like that, and he sent them out to proclaim the kingdom of God. So when they're unable to do anything about this demonized boy, it came as a surprise. The other thing that you need to know is more just adding a little bit of color or texture to what's going on in this moment, because Jesus has just taken his inner circle of disciples, Peter, James, and John, up onto the mountaintop. He is transfigured. They see him with Elijah and Moses, and they realize that something else is going on here. It is a big, big moment where they get a very unique glimpse into really the power of God and maybe a more fuller understanding of who Jesus is. So I think there's meant to be a contrast there. You have the literal mountaintop moment, and then they come down and they see a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. So you come from this mountaintop experience to a bunch of bickering. It's like having the best vacation of your life and then coming home and having a fight. It's like, feels like whiplash. And scribes are arguing with them. Again, these, it's not 100% clear who they are. They're probably associated with Bible copiers, which is a very specialized, very honored position in their culture. They seem to also be leaders among the Pharisees. And so all the crowd, when they see Jesus, they're greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you?" Next slide, please. Arguing about with them. Now, most likely, and for kind of a confluence of obnoxious grammatical reasons, Jesus seems to be possibly actually saying this to the scribes. Kind of like, what are you doing with my guys here? Because they've had conflict before. And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute." Now, they didn't actually bring him to Jesus. They were looking for Jesus, and it turns out he was busy. So his disciples stepped in and seemed to think that they could handle this. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth. And next slide, please. Becomes rigid. "So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." Now, there's a lot to be said here, and I think we've had this conversation before. Because reading this as a modern person, you might say, that sounds like a seizure. And if you've ever had the unfortunate experience of watching somebody have a seizure, it does kind of look like a demon possession. Like, it's like, yikes, especially when you don't know it's coming. You've never seen one before. I speak from experience. And it's a very complex, difficult question that I just want to raise and then not answer, because that's easier for me and harder for you. It becomes a really big question of how much of this is an ancient culture with a very limited understanding, or I should say, very different understanding of the human body and the brain, trying to make sense of what they're seeing and experiencing, and how much of this is actually a dark spirit of some kind. I don't know. I just don't know. You could honestly kind of read it as either. It sounds like Mark is pretty convinced that this is a demon, but again, is he filtering that through his worldview? But then also, are we filtering that through our worldview? And are we being arrogant enough to think that as modern Western post-enlightenment people, we have it all figured out and ancient people are kind of dumb and they don't know anything? Which is probably not the best route to go either. So I will throw that cat among the pigeons and move on. And so he answered them. This is Jesus. O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? That seems to be an idiom. I don't think it's meant to be like just a full-on insult. Although it's definitely not flattering. So he says, bring him to me, and they bring the boy, or they brought the boy to Jesus. Next slide, please. So, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and it fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. So, and Jesus asked the father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And it, next slide, please, has often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. So Mark is kind of unique in this sense that even though he's the shortest gospel, he likes to add a lot of extra details. It's hard to know exactly what those details meant to him, but it does give you a picture of the condition. Again, if this is like a neurological disorder, if this is a dark spirit, some kind of demonic force causing a neurological disorder, but at the same time, we get the image of a condition that is life-threatening. It has been a part of this whole family's life for many years. And you get also the impression that it's not like an occasional thing, like a one-off, you know, once a year sort of thing. But it's fairly consistent. It's kind of always there. It's always on the forefront of their minds, and especially as a parent, I'm sure dad is constantly worried about this, constantly experiencing that fear, and I can only imagine what the boy is thinking. So in some sense, it's like a really, really talkative, like, teenage girl who's just irrepressible. It's just like, there's nothing they can do about it. It's just there. So, it makes perfect sense for this father to say, if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. This is the question of somebody who's kind of, like, at the end of his rope. And maybe is kind of wondering, is this just what life is going to be? And yeah, Jesus has this reputation of being able to heal people, but this is pretty bad. So Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible for one who believes. This verse, taken out of its context, and really taken out of the context of the entirety of the New Testament, at least, is dangerous. Because it seems to suggest that anything is possible so long as I have enough faith, and therefore if I attempt the tremendously difficult, if I pray for the miracle, if I, you know, plead before God and try my hardest and believe my hardest, and it doesn't work out, then what's the problem? Oh, the problem is I didn't have enough faith. And I would like to disabuse all of us from this notion, because it's currently a problem. I think it used to be more so an American thing, but the problem is growing. Because I can think of two people right off the bat who prayed to God, and God specifically says no. Those two people, the Apostle Paul, who had some kind of major, somewhat debilitating health condition, and God said, no, I'm going to use this for something else. And the other person being Jesus, who prays in the Garden of Gethsemane, knowing the torture that is coming, Father, if it's your will, take this cup from me. And I'd like to think that if anybody has enough faith, it's Jesus. So Mark is narrated, immediately the father of the child cried out, and this is in response to Jesus' words, he says, I believe, help my unbelief. Now bookmark that, because we're going to come back to it in a bit. So Jesus saw that a crowd came running together. Certainly the same crowd that had watched his disciples fail multiple times. He rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. That's kind of a different way of casting out some sort of demonic spirit from the way Jesus normally does it. But anyway, and after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, actually, we'll stop there, period. It's a good place to stop. So this happens, and the kid gets up, and he's okay. Everyone thinks he's dead. And then what follows are his disciples going, I mean, a couple weeks ago, it seems like we could have done that. So when he had entered the house, so they're in kind of a more private space, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? And Jesus said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. Now that should raise a question. Because it implies, first off, that the disciples didn't pray. Okay. But also, when Jesus cast out that, well, just for the sake of argument, just that demonic spirit, this condition, he doesn't pray either. So why does Jesus not have to, but his disciples do? And the answer, or at least the best explanation I could find, this is R.T. France, who explains that probably, as the disciples were commissioned and granted power from God through Jesus to go and do the work they did as he sent them out, and then they come back, when by the time they get to this point, they seem to be under the assumption that they still have that kind of authority and can do these kinds of things apart from first connecting with the one who gives them that power. Does that make sense? I'm seeing some Blake stares and a couple of nods. Which, I get it. This is weird. This whole thing is weird. Because by not praying, which evidently the disciples didn't, they weren't taking a step back and connecting with the one who gives them that kind of authority over the darkness. Now, there's kind of a ready-made application there for those of us who are following Jesus, meaning we're supposed to be a light to the world and a light in the darkness, a light among people with whom we interact. We are supposed to represent the kingdom of God. We're supposed to bring a different way of living and being into the world. And how many times have we, in some form or fashion, whether we consciously did it or maybe just subconsciously thought that that's what we were doing, kind of stepped out into a situation to be that light without first recognizing we represent God, and without first connecting with God, speaking with Him and hearing from Him in prayer? I mean, is anyone here guilty of that? Don't raise your hand. And so at the very least, I mean, I would assume most of us are not encountering some sort of demonic spirit slash maybe epileptic disorder, I don't know, every day, but I'm sure we encounter people every day who need the love of Jesus. And if anything, this should at least be an encouragement to pray. Even just the Lord's Prayer, which recognizes that everything belongs to God and that it is His goal to bring His rule and reign here through us. It acknowledges our own brokenness and begs for forgiveness, but also implicitly, or actually explicitly, encourages us to forgive people. It's got everything. It's a good start. Prayer doesn't have to be fancy. Now I want to go back to the bookmark, because Jesus says all things are possible for those who believe, and this father recognizes his own limitations by saying, I believe, help my unbelief. And what's interesting is that within certain scholarly circles and commentators on the New Testament and so on and so forth, there's a tendency to get hung up on this. I don't know if it's because they're just trying to be like hyper-logical or something like that, but it raises the question of like, what? Believe, but then also not believe. Like, how can you have faith and then say, help me because I don't have faith? And so they come up with all kinds of, you know, circus-level explanations for how this father could think or feel this way. To me, man, I feel that. I feel that tension. Like, I believe, and I also have doubts. Like, I believe what God has said about me, that I am buried with Jesus in my baptism. I am raised to walk in new life. Death is defeated. My sins are forgiven. Jesus has placed His Spirit within me. I am a living temple of God. That God has marked me, He is by the power of His Spirit growing me into someone who looks a little bit more like Jesus over time. And then I can also look at my life and say, really? Because doesn't look like it. On the one hand, like, I can raise doubts just about my own life, my own inability to live up to God's standards. The epistle reading in James is notorious for this. He's saying, like, your mouth causes so much sin, and he's saying this to all of us, and it's true. How much of our sinful, destructive action comes out of our mouth? The answer is a lot. To the extent, I think it's John Ortberg once said that so much of the sin we commit is because of what we say. So if you want to sin less, just talk less. It's genius. Just tape my mouth shut. But then there are other ways to doubt. I mean, this guy is kind of at the end of his rope. He doesn't think Jesus is maybe necessarily capable of helping. And so there are other ways to doubt. There are intellectual reasons to doubt. There are things about the Christian faith that just don't always make sense to me. And I'm your pastor. Like, I'm paid to be a Christian. I mean, not really, but, you know, that would be deeply unsettling. But in a sense, like, I'm a professional Christian. Like, and if I find myself with plenty of reasons to doubt at times, I can't be alone in that. It's just not possible. And so as a follower of Jesus, we exist in this very awkward, uncomfortable tension of we believe, we've been given the gift of faith, and by lifestyle or thought or worldview or whatever you want to call it, there are things that make that belief hard or challenge it. Or sometimes it feels like it pushes it to its breaking point. And so commentators like struggle to make sense of why this guy would say this to Jesus. But in reality, man, this just fits. Like, this guy and I would be friends. And his discomfort or his tension would be a problem if faith were an act that we commit. Let me say this another way. If my faith is a result of my effort to believe really hard or think very deeply or live very, very well and tape my mouth shut so the terrible things don't come out or whatever, then we'd be in trouble. You will eventually burn out. Or you will convince yourself that you've succeeded, and so therefore you are special. And that's even worse. But faith isn't just a thing you do, or a thing you muster, or a thing that you kind of think through or just believe really hard, because if that were true, then that would mean that we're actually saved by our own actions. And unless I've completely misunderstood the entirety of the biblical narrative, possible but probably unlikely, then faith is actually God's gift to me. Faith is created within me. That's part of the gift of baptism. And if the faith that I have stems from God's action, not my own, and yet, on the other hand, there's still all of these questions, all of these actions, all of these things deep within me that would question this faith, well, then suddenly this doesn't seem quite so big of a threat. The faith that God has given you is God's gift to you by the Spirit through Jesus. And so the doubts, the struggles, the ways that we live, the ways that we fall short of God's standard, the intellectual doubts that creep in, the whatever we might put over here, it's just doubt. Maybe the best way through doubt isn't to just try and hit it really hard with a hammer or try really, really hard to believe, but instead rest on the fact that faith is a gift. And over time, the tension of doubt has a tendency to work its own way out. And with this father expressing his doubts to Jesus, notice Jesus doesn't say, "How dare you? But instead, he just heals his boy and takes him to him. Because the faith that this man has is marred, and as much as he is struggling with his own doubt and his own experience, is in fact a gift. And if the faith that this man has is a gift to him, of course it is a gift to us. Amen.